FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Glad to have you with us. A very, very busy show ahead of you here on your Wednesday afternoon, as coming up in the second half of the show, we are going to be speaking with someone who's been doing some investigative work on this group called Acronym, which is the parent company of the group called Shadow, which is, by the way, something you can't make up, that made that app that was infamous in Iowa for reporting those caucus results, as we're going to be speaking with Noah Kulin of the Outline magazine, as he was able to speak with a couple of anonymous employees that work for Acronym that just overall describe an absolutely chaotic work environment at Acronym. So that'll be coming up in the second half of the show. But first, going to bring back our good friend David Schultz of Hamline University. He is a political science professor and a leading political analyst here, not just in Minnesota, but the entire country, as we have a lot to cover. Professor Schultz, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. Man, I don't even know where to start with all these topics. We got the State of the Union. We got impeachment. We got the Iowa caucuses. And maybe if when we get time, we can talk about the legislature. But yeah, there is no shortage of news in the world of politics this week.
No, you're absolutely correct. In many ways, several of them all converge together, because the Iowa caucuses, the State of the Union, the presidential election, the impeachment, I mean, they're all joined to the hip at this point, we can pretty much say.
Exactly. Let's start off with impeachment, though, because the breaking news we're getting this afternoon is that Mitt Romney is a yes on voting to convict President Trump in the Senate impeachment trial. And this is really significant, I think, for Democrats, because the Republicans have been able to use this argument for the last few months, saying this is a completely partisan impeachment. No Republicans in the House voted in favor of impeachment. It looked like that could be in the case in the Senate as well. But now Democrats do at least have that argument of saying, well, this technically now is a bipartisan Senate trial where we're going to have senators from both parties voting to convict President Trump.
No, I think this is a pretty big coup for the Democrats in terms of being able to make that argument. And one also has to applaud Mitt Romney. You know, Mitt Romney, you know, could have capitulated in the same way that Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and you know, Lamar Alexander did, in terms of saying that, well, we think the behavior is bad, but kind of give him a free pass on this one. Mitt Romney's basically reached the conclusion that, based on the evidence, you know, that he's seen presented so far, that he believes it's an impeachable offense, and he's going to put what? Country ahead of party, which is what you're supposed to do.
And overall, Mitt Romney is, for lack of a better way of putting it, pretty much bulletproof in Utah. I mean, the Republicans could try to primary him all they want whenever he's up for re-election again, which I don't even think is until 2024. But he's so popular in that state, there's really nothing they can use against him that would have any effect on his Senate career.
No, you're absolutely correct. He's about as secure a Republican as you can possibly get. And again, as you pointed out, he doesn't stand for re-election for four and a half years, we should say, at this point, which means during that time period, an eternity of things could happen also. So he was able to do something that I think a lot of Republicans couldn't do, which is to say, I don't have to worry about the primary. I don't have to worry about the sort of the mass politics of 90% of the Republican base supporting Donald Trump, which means I have to support him no matter what. He was able to do what I think senators are supposed to do, which is to make, again, an independent judgment. Now, we also shouldn't discount the fact that Mitt Romney and Donald Trump probably don't like one another, and there's probably some background bad blood that's going on there also. But nonetheless, this is significant because it does change the narrative, but it also now puts enormous pressure on people like Joe Manchin, for example, who's a Democrat in West Virginia, that the Republicans will probably try to push him really, really hard to vote no on the impeachment charges, so that they can also claim that what? That a Democrat voted for their side.
Right, exactly. And one of those potential Democrats who might have been able to vote no on that, Doug Jones, actually decided today that he will vote to convict Donald Trump. And looking at some other possible swing senators, it sounds like Cory Gardner, the very vulnerable former Republican from Colorado, says he'll likely be a no on impeachment. So at least in the cases of Doug Jones and Cory Gardner, who are facing very tough re-elections this fall, is this pretty much the end of their political careers with the ways that they're voting? I would say especially for the case of Cory Gardner.
I think so, too. And also, Doug Jones is going to be a hard one anyhow. That he won a special election, what was it, 2 years ago? Was it in 18, I believe? 2 years ago in 18, you know, in a very tough election, but he ran against an incredibly vulnerable Republican. This is a long shot for the Democrats to hold this seat down in Alabama. And I think he just decided at this point that he's going to go down swinging. He's going to vote, you know, either for party or vote for conscience, and hope that maybe he can win re-election, although the prospects are pretty thin.
And final question about impeachment before we move on to some other topics. And this is kind of the changing attitude we've seen from Republicans and even the White House defense team, is they're essentially now admitting that, yes, Trump actually is guilty of the charges, but the punishment doesn't meet the level of being removed from office. Could there actually be any backlash from the Trump White House or other Republicans? Because a lot of them actually are admitting, oh yeah, he's absolutely guilty of essentially bribing the Ukrainians, but he doesn't deserve to actually get removed from office.
Yeah, first off, you're right. With the exception of Donald Trump himself and let's say the core of his White House, who still think it was, to use this phrase, a perfect phone call, very few people are making that defense. The Republicans' defense is to say, it was inappropriate, it was wrong, but it doesn't meet whatever that high burden is to show that the president deserves to be removed from office. And I think the president, as we have seen, likes 100% loyalty to him, although he doesn't reciprocate with that. He's going to probably still campaign against some of them, and I wouldn't be surprised for some of them who have taken the position similar to what you just described here. He might actually try to encourage people to primary some of those Republicans from the right.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of curious about, is if that could happen, because, yeah, that certainly doesn't really make him look good by saying, oh, yeah, you're guilty, but it just doesn't meet the level of actually being removed from office. I could still see that being very problematic for Trump himself, who is also, as we all know, a very thin-skinned guy.
Well, exactly, and that's the point that I think we're both making here, is that they are, and which is what I think the Democrats were hoping, is that they were hoping that the Republicans, when faced with the prospect of defending the president, or if they're facing election this year, maneuvering to protect themselves, would run adrift of some problems. And that's exactly what's happening now, is that these Republicans are trying to have it both ways, protect the president but also figure out a way of still protecting their seat. And it may turn out the retaliation comes not from the voters directly, but it may come from the president and from his core base, that will not like the fact that they admitted that he did something wrong.
So what I would be interested in seeing is if the Democrats actually call out the Republicans' bluff on this issue. Earlier today we had, I'm blanking on the name of the California senator that was calling for this alternative of just censuring the president. Of course, we heard some talks about this in the House. Now we're also hearing about it in the Senate as well. So if the Democrats were to actually go ahead and say, all right, well, let's actually just censure the president instead, that would be a really interesting way to actually call some of the bluffs on the Republicans to see if they actually do believe what they're saying, and that, oh, yeah, he's guilty, but it just doesn't mean he should be removed from office.
No, I think that would be actually a really great wedge issue for the Democrats to do at this point, is to either, after the impeachment vote, call for a censure, or in lieu of it, propose as an alternative that the president, you know, they vote on a censure. And again, this was, I think, Joe Manchin's suggestion from West Virginia. I hadn't heard about the California.
I think it might have been Boxer. Yeah, it wasn't Harris. I think it might have been Boxer. But yeah, continue.
Okay. But whoever it is, I think it would be a great issue, right, to call a bluff and also to squeeze some of the Republicans into forcing them into taking a position that they're really trying to avoid to do at this point.
All right, so let's talk about the State of the Union last night and the paper shred heard around the world. I didn't get a chance to watch this live. I just happened to catch the GIF on Twitter, and boy, it's amazing how far we've kind of gone off the rails on a State of the Union address, where we already started with the president refusing to shake the hand of Nancy Pelosi, then Nancy Pelosi shredding the speech of Donald Trump. And more, the State of the Union seems to be completely going off the rails as the years and years continue, because that kind of almost makes what happened, what was it, like 2009, where we had the guy yell at Barack Obama, "You lie,"
right,
that almost pales in comparison to what we were seeing from some of the antics last night.
No, you're absolutely right. And if you think about what the State of the Union is supposed to be, this is constitutionally obligated, and it's supposed to be what? It's supposed to be the State of the Union. Now, we, you know, how's the United States doing and so forth? This is what, you know, this is what the framers intended it to be. But we know that it has become kind of a partisan speech, and especially in an election year, it's become a political speech. But most presidents have sort of put it within boundaries. You know, most of them, in fact, I'm going to say all of them prior to Trump, haven't turned it into a reality show, haven't turned it into a kind of a, you know, a juvenile behavior. And that's what really happened last night, is that Trump, as he has so many times, crossed some boundaries, refuses to shake Pelosi's hand, which would have been, you know, just the pro forma thing to do. And then she, of course, retaliated by refusing, you know, by tearing up the State of the Union speech. But think about how this plays for his base. His base refusing to take her hand is going to play exceedingly well for many Democrats. Her shredding the State of the Union speech will play exceedingly well. So to a large extent, these are for great base politics. Also, I was going to say that his show almost reminded me of the television show The Price is Right, you know, where he's kind of like almost a reality show, game show aspect to it in terms of handing out congressional medals of honor and stuff like that. I mean, this is clearly political pandering in ways that have crossed lines that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah, and you wonder, too, is that are the politicians, and I'm not just speaking about the president, who, of course, is the person giving the State of the Union address, but, yeah, talking about the Speaker of the House and other people who are attending the State of the Union. It really is just about getting those media clips, because as I even look at the TV ratings from last night, I think they were reported to be 25% down from the previous year. So maybe it is, as you're saying, yeah, just making it that game show aspect where you can just have those nice little 5 to 10 second clips that you can show after the address is actually done.
Well, isn't it true? It's just like with the debates. I mean, the percentage of people or populations actually watching the presidential debates is low. So you as a candidate want to find something that will go viral or the media will report. And it's the same thing. Not that many people are really watching that speech, you know, or at least paying attention mm-hmm. to it in vivid detail. So again, by doing what we saw, you know, in terms of both of the antics there, again, that's what everybody's talking about today. No one's talking about what the substance of what he actually said. Although a few people are pointing out the fact that truth seemed to die yet again in that speech, where there were an awful lot of fact checkers who questioned an awful lot of the assertions being made by the president.
Yeah, certainly yeoman's work trying to be doing fact-checking during a State of the Union speech from President Trump. Yeah, that's definitely not an easy job. Hey, you're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. We're speaking with David Schultz of Hamline University. So let's talk about the Iowa caucuses from Monday night, because how much does this actually screw up the Democratic primary as a whole? Obviously, it has a huge impact in Iowa, not just now, but also in the future. But this also sort of has a domino effect heading into New Hampshire and the other states, since, well, in the past, Iowa was really used as kind of that winnowing state where you sometimes would get a number of candidates dropping off, or at least candidates that would be seeing a lot less media coverage than they typically would. So what is the overall domino effect of this entire fiasco we saw in Iowa on Monday?
Well, there's several of them. One of them is also that somebody's hoping to come out of Iowa with some type of momentum, both in terms of fundraising and in terms of public opinion. You really don't have that. Even though right now, you know, Mayor Pete Buttigieg wants to claim that he's the winner, even though what we only have as of the time of this, you know, recording, what, 70 or 72%
yeah.
of the returns in, you know, and it's, which means you really, and it being how close it is with Sanders, you probably don't want to declare victory. But well, it's not clear how much of a bump he gets, because what's the story? That he potentially won Iowa, or all about how bad Iowa got screwed up? So So that hurts in terms of that momentum. The second thing is, you're right. Once again, based upon what we have so far, and again, it's not conclusive, but Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar came in fifth. She did not beat Buttigieg, who was her main rival to Joe Biden. And that's not a great performance when you think about it. Mm-hmm. But yet, she's not being winnowed out. She's going on to New Hampshire. I don't think I've heard a single person saying as a result of Iowa they're dropping out. And in fact, I think besides Donald Trump, the absolute biggest winner was Michael Bloomberg. Because Bloomberg was criticized for saying, well, you've entered late, you're not going to be in Iowa, you're going to be hurt by all of this. Since I think Iowa has largely been rendered unimportant right now, Bloomberg, I think, looks pretty good coming out of this.
Yeah, in a way he does. I could also see how he could potentially be disappointed as well, because I think the ultimate win for Bloomberg would have been an overwhelming Bernie Sanders victory, because he wants to portray himself as being, well, I'm the alternative to Bernie Sanders instead of Joe Biden.
Right.
I also think he would have been very happy with a bad night for Joe Biden, which it looks like it did happen, but as we're kind of alluding to, the effect might not necessarily be felt.
No, you're absolutely right. So I can maybe take my second backup position and say that maybe Bloomberg isn't the clear winner, but he certainly isn't hurt dramatically by what happened. And it gives people, again, like Amy Klobuchar, who, if this had been a clean Iowa caucus and she came in fifth, it was going to be difficult for her. I still do think it's going to be difficult for her coming in fifth. We're not going to see a lot of new money coming into the campaign for her. So she's going to have a hard time claiming, despite what she thinks, claiming any momentum going into New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, she's...
And Iowa was going to be her make-or-break state for her campaign. So she's lost on the sense that she doesn't get that momentum.
Yeah, and I think instead of her completely going down the drain, she's just, well, to use an analogy, kind of just circling around the drain right now. And you brought up that important point. I mean, who's actually going to be giving money to her anymore? Because I can't imagine she's going to have a lot of campaign finances to actually spend in New Hampshire.
No, you're right. And I think at this point, as she was building herself as the alternative to Biden, as opposed to Buttigieg, people are maybe not going to give money to Biden, because it's not going to be until perhaps Nevada that he can resuscitate, if at all, or South Carolina. And two, if she's supposed to be the alternative to Biden and not Buttigieg, Buttigieg is way ahead of her at this point. It's getting hard to figure out what's the rationale of giving her money at this point.
So taking a look at what happened in Iowa, obviously we had the absolute disaster with that app that they had. And I overall think it's not necessarily the app that was the problem. It was more the fact that they had no good backup system in place whatsoever, because I remember them talking about, oh, well, we have a backup for a backup for a backup for a backup. And it turns out their second string backup was just completely jammed the entire night. That would be the phone lines that they were trying to get to. So I think that's obviously a very bad look for the state of Iowa. Do they ultimately lose their first in the nation status, you think, as we head into 2024? Because it's also important to point out, it's not just the Democrats that have messed this up. In 2012, I think it was even more egregious when Republicans declared the wrong winner, where they originally had Mitt Romney, and then they said 2 weeks later, oh yeah, it was actually Rick Santorum who won our caucus. So what do you think actually impacts for 24?
Well, first off, you know, it's always been hard for Iowa to defend its position. You know, we're looking at a caucus state that is one of the whitest in the country, and it's not overly representative, you know, of, let's say, the demographics of the United States. And it, again, being a caucus as opposed to a primary, we're also only looking at what, maybe about 10% of the population. So we're looking at about maybe 10% of one of the whitest states in the country having this potentially huge influence on presidential campaign. So I think it's always been hard to justify their position. And even without what was happening on Monday night, their position was starting to weaken dramatically. Super Tuesday comes. California's earlier than it was ever in the past. Iowa doesn't look like it's quite as important. And so put all those together. And then what happened again on Monday night, I think you're going to see serious pressure both on Iowa being first and two, on whether the caucus system remains a viable decision-making system whatsoever.
What I would wonder, too, because it obviously wouldn't be a good look for the DNC just to put the hammer down on Iowa and say, well, you're no longer the first nation in the state primary or caucus. Do you think it actually could be the type of thing where we have maybe a bigger state like Texas or California or Florida say, you know what, we're moving up our primary to late January just to kind of do that by default and actually become the first in the nation?
Yeah, and that's what I'm suspecting is going to happen. Mm-hmm. You're going to get another state that's going to get very, very close to Iowa. Because no matter, I don't think people remember, back in 2008, because South Carolina had moved around, the Iowa caucuses were the first week of January. Because everybody was pushing things around. Iowa has said, we're always going to be first no matter what. And so I think just another state will concede and say, sure, you can be first, but we, a California or a New York or whatever state like that, we're going to come, I don't know, 7 days after you or something like that. And that's what's going to change the complexion of the game.
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, for instance, you had the Monday caucuses and maybe like a Friday primary in California. That would certainly dilute the effect of what would happen in Iowa. Yeah, so
exactly.
Because overall, I mean, Iowa obviously gets a ton of money from these presidential campaigns coming throughout the state, especially those radio and TV stations down there. But, yeah, something probably is going to happen in the future, and it will have a major impact on that economy.
No, you're absolutely right. But I just can't see at this point how anybody can really sort of trust. It's terrible to say because, I know in Minnesota we like to pick on Iowa. It's kind of a friendly joke, but getting beyond that, I just can't see how, from a political perspective, anybody can take a chance in wanting to say, let's go with Iowa as the first in the country again. And have confidence given some of the problems they had, especially this year. So I think de facto Iowa is probably dead in terms of the level of influence that it's going to have on presidential elections compared to the past.
Yeah, I agree with you. Something will definitely happen before we head to the 2024 primaries and caucuses. We've been speaking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. You can find a lot of his writings over at schultzestake.blogspot.com. David, always good to visit with you, and we shall check in with you in the next few days and weeks.
My pleasure, and thanks to everybody for listening.
Absolutely. Hey, and by the way, thanks to everyone who also attended that forum we had at Hamline University last week. Good turnout there as we had a nice discussion about impeachment and politics in general. We'll actually play back parts of that forum on future versions of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Take a break and come back with more as you're listening to AM 950.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
If you or someone you know needs dental care but can't afford it, go to Shamblot Family Dentistry's 14th annual Dentistry from the Heart event on Wednesday, February 12th, beginning at 7 a.m. It's a day of free dentistry for those in need. All patients will be seen on a first-come, first-served basis. No appointment required. Dentistry from the Heart provides free, limited dental care to those in need. This event is for new patients. Since 20% of adults know they have cavities but haven't had them filled, and over 100 million Americans lack dental insurance, this event meets a huge need in our community. Shamblot Family Dentistry has given away almost $400,000 in free dentistry through Dentistry from the Heart. Again, Dentistry from the Heart is Wednesday, February 12th, beginning at 7 a.m. at Shamblot Family Dentistry in Hopkins at 33 10th Avenue South and at their new St. Paul location, 400 Selby Avenue in the Blair Arcade Building. It's first come, first served, so arrive early.
Hi, I'm Frank Brown, owner of the only minority-owned union print shop in Minnesota.
Do you work with political campaigns?
Yes, we have years of experience helping campaigns.
Do you help with design?
Yes, our employees have over 100 years of industry experience and are the best at what they do.
So you print anything a political campaign might need?
Yes, we print everything. Work with a printer for your political campaign that shares your values. Minuteman Press Uptown. Learn more at mpuptown.com. Minuteman Press Uptown. We print everything.
You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on your Wednesday afternoon. We'll do a very quick segment before we get to Noah Coolwin of the Outline magazine, as we're going to take a bit of an inside look at this shadowy company. I still love using that pun, since Shadow is the name of that company that came up with that app. And you got to love the name of that parent company too, Eric Acronym.
Yeah,
I mean, who comes up with names for tech firms? Yeah, we're Acronym. We need to come up with a tech firm, you and I, like, called Period, and just make some app.
The business store.
Yeah, the business store. That's almost what kind of happened, where you just had a couple of smart techie people come up with this firm, and what they did was just got a bunch of money from billionaires by using buzzwords like SEO and analytics and impressions. They gave them millions of dollars, and all of a sudden, someone at the DNC probably thought, this person's kid knows how to develop apps. Let's have them be in charge of the Iowa caucus app. That's probably not actually far off from what actually happened when they came up with this app that they used down in Iowa. One other piece of news before we do head to our break and then get some insider information about Acronym, the parent company of the company that made that Iowa caucus app. So this is being reported that a number of faith-based DFL lawmakers are pushing legislation to create state-based rent subsidy programs for low-income Minnesotans. And overall, these subsidies could total about $1 billion. So on the surface, this looks like a step in the right direction for me. I've often talked about how the lack of affordable housing is a political issue that is not getting enough play whatsoever, especially in presidential politics. Now, this $1 billion subsidy program that's being proposed by DFLers is a step in the right direction. But what I think you ultimately need to do is actually look at the landlord side of the equation. And I'm not someone who necessarily sits there and blames, landlords are just getting greedy with the way they're charging rent. I think you actually need a much more comprehensive solution when it comes to trying to get affordable housing rental units. I think we need to maybe look at having maybe tax incentives for companies to actually build affordable housing units, maybe even rent controls, although there's certainly problems with that. But this at least does take care of, if we look at this from an equation, you have the revenue side and the expense side. So the revenue side is obviously what you use to actually pay your rent, but the expense is actually what the rent costs. This subsidy program that's being proposed by the DFLers, that helps that revenue equation, but it still doesn't actually stop landlords from actually saying, we're just going to raise your rent by whatever amount your subsidy actually is. That's at least from the more cynical perspective from landlords who actually are, for lack of a better way of putting it, very greedy.
But ultimately, it's a way to make money, right? Mm-hmm. They're landlords as a business.
Yeah.
They're going to charge you whatever they can.
But I also get it is a very fair argument that there's also a lot of landlords who aren't making a lot of money on affordable housing units. They're also living through very tight margins. It's overall a very complicated issue, and no one's really taken a very comprehensive look on actually how you solve that issue, because it's not something that's going away. I mean, we heard last night so often, we have a booming economy here in this country. Well, yeah, it actually is booming to a degree, if you're looking at the revenue side of the equation in terms of how much money we're making. By the way, Eric, I think we got our guest ringing in on line 4, so we can go ahead and get to them coming up in the next segment. But what often isn't talked about is how much the cost of living has gone up in the country, especially when it comes to healthcare, then of course affordable housing. And like I talked about, it's something we just often don't hear about, especially with the presidential campaigns. I don't think we've even had a single question about that at any of the presidential debates. But like I said, at least this move by some of these DFL House members is a step in the right direction, but we still need to have a much bigger conversation about this and also tackle, the landlord side of that too, in terms of how much rent they can actually raise. And also, I still think it's not a bad idea to talk about some sort of subsidies that you can actually give to builders that would incentivize them to actually build affordable housing units rather than the endless luxury apartments we see, especially in Minneapolis. 952-946-6205. We will be taking your calls towards the end of the show, but coming up on the other side of the break, we are going to be speaking with Noah Coolwin as we're going to be talking about this Akronin Group, again, who is the parent company of the company that actually built that Iowa caucus app. We'll talk more about that coming up next.
This is Chad, owner of AM950. Our station has worked with Barbara from WYSIWYG Web Design for years on everything from logo to print design and especially for developing our website. She does great work and is great to work with, listening to what our goals and design ideas were while offering new, innovative ideas to create the website we are proud of today. Barbara made sure she understood our station, our goals, and our mission before she started working on our site and made suggestions to help control the cost. Plus, she's friendly, which set us at ease. I recommend Barbara at WYSIWYG Web Design because I know she will deliver an attractive, professional website within the budget you have. She is a local independent business that specializes in helping other local businesses achieve their website and design goals. She can work with nearly any budget and create anything from simple sites to robust custom functionality. To find out more about the company AM950 Trust, go to WYSIWYGWebDesign.com. Spelled out just like it sounds, WYSIWYGWebDesign.com.
The Blue State Ball is back, and this year we're doing things a little differently. It'll be less of a formal ball and more of a fun bash with beer. It takes place Sunday, February 23rd at Bauhaus Brew Labs in Minneapolis with our headliner, Tom Hartman. It's also the 15-year anniversary of AM950 opening, so let's get fired up about beating Trump and celebrate 15 years of AM950 bringing a progressive perspective to the airwaves. VIP is at noon and includes a meet and greet with Tom and other AM950 personalities, a complimentary beer or non-alcoholic beverage, and snacks and appetizers. Then doors for general admission open at 1. VIP tickets are $75, general admission $40. Both VIP and general admission tickets include a signed copy of Tom Hartman's newest book, The Hidden History of the War on Voting. Again, this year's Blue State Ball is going to be a little less formal, but even more fun. That's Sunday, February 23rd at Bauhaus Brew Labs in Minneapolis with lots of free parking around the brewery. And don't wait, this year's ball will sell out. So order tickets now at am950radio.com.
Finding the right lawyer is incredibly stressful. It can be tough to know even where to start. Don't just run an internet search for an attorney. Start with the Minnesota Lawyer Referral and Information Service, an enhanced program of the Hennepin and Ramsey County Bar Associations. They'll connect you with over 200 thoroughly vetted, qualified attorneys practicing in over 50 areas of law. Call 612-752-6699 or go to mnlawyerreferral.org. The right call for the right lawyer.
With your AM950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Today will be mostly sunny with a high near 29. And by tonight, partly cloudy skies with a low around 12. Thursday will be sunny with a high near 28 and a low around 20 with a 30% chance of snow. Friday, the snow may continue with a high of 27 and a low of 16.
Don't miss the Healthy Life Expo this Saturday and Sunday at the Minneapolis Convention Center. Up to 200 vendors, 4 speaker stages, giveaways, and more. The Healthy Life Expo this Saturday and Sunday at the Minneapolis Convention Center. See it all at expoguys.com. That's expoguys.com.
You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, a live version of our Wednesday afternoon show. Well, happy to be speaking now with Noah Coolwin of The Outline, as we are going to be talking about this shadowy group called Akronin, which is a tech firm backed by many Democratic donors that is the parent company of Shadow, who developed that very infamous Iowa caucuses app, which completely failed on Monday night. And Noah has kind of an interesting angle, being that he was able to speak to a number of employees anonymously who work for this company called Akronin. So, Noah, welcome to the program. Good to have you on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what exactly is this company Akronin? Can you give us some background on who they are, who's funding it, and who's in charge?
Sure. So Akronin was launched in 2017 ahead of the 2018 midterm cycle. And it was launched by a Democratic operative named Tara McGowan, who previously was a top digital staffer for Priorities Action USA, which is the big super PAC that evolved out of the Obama 2012 campaign and the Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign. And the idea behind Acronym when it was initially launched was that they were just going to do, you know, digital campaigning, making content, making advertising, and targeting voters in ways that Democrats had not done before. The exact specifics and nature of that were always a little hazy, but that's not anything particularly new. And then last year, actually a few months ago, Acronym took on a much higher profile with the announcement that they were planning to spend $75 million on an effort to run ads in a variety of battleground states. And the structure of Acronym is such that they have a few different smaller organizations that they own that are effectively their subsidiaries. And because Acronym is a dark money group, meaning that it doesn't really have to disclose much about its donors, we don't necessarily have a good idea of how these groups operate, who works for them, who is on the boards of these subsidiary organizations, and simultaneously, what role McGowan and the Acronym leadership has in them.
And Shadow is one of those subsidiaries of Acronym. And Shadow, of course, is the company that developed that app that was used in Iowa. And at least in the very limited research I've been doing, Noah, it really just does seem like Acronym and Shadow are really just the same company. I mean, I've looked back at LinkedIn profiles, some past tweets, even some website edits they've made over the past few days. And yeah, it really looks like Acronym was very much the same kind of company as Shadow. In fact, some reports even showed that they're even housed in the same building.
Yes, and that was what my reporting showed as well, that Acronym and Shadow staffers were, and staffers from other subsidiary groups of Acronym, you know, they attended the same meetings, they shared office space, they shared resources. They were just sort of different units of the same larger entity. And I don't think that that would necessarily be so controversial were it not for the fact that Acronym leadership actively tried to put distance between themselves and Shadow as soon as things started to go haywire on Monday night in Iowa.
So you had a chance to speak to a number of employees anonymously, and what they described was pretty much a chaotic environment. I mean, I liked what one of them said, where it sounded like they were just basically thrown into a room and told, create content and then promote it on social media. Is that kind of the feeling you were getting too, that it was just really a very disorganized, chaotic environment that was created?
Yes, and I think that it's sort of, I think that it's an institutional culture. My impression, at least, and I don't want to get ahead of my skis here on this, but my impression from the conversations that I had was just that this was a company that raised an enormous amount of money very quickly and did not necessarily have the capacity to spend it effectively in a short period of time.
And, yeah, some of this disorganization and lack of really having a mission can sometimes be typical from a normal tech startup, but I kind of feel like, and I've had experience dealing people who work in kind of the social media marketing, where if you use enough buzzwords like SEO tools and impressions and views, yeah, it's very easy to sell people sometimes who do have a lot of money to think, oh, well, I'm hearing all these buzzwords. This company might actually be doing a good job, and it sounds like they're going to promote our message. And at least in my opinion, that kind of sounds like what this company Acronym actually is that, yeah, they got a lot of these billionaire Democratic donors to just give them a whole boatload of money when they weren't necessarily always delivering on the results that they promised.
And I think that this is, that's exactly right. And that this is a sort of problem within the wider world of political consultancies, particularly within the Democratic Party. I think that part of the reason that also these kinds of failures in terms of execution go overlooked, or at least that there aren't, doesn't seem like there are consequences, is because of the very the nepotistic relationships that exist within this world. And I'm not somebody who believes that there's any sort of like large, grand, active conspiracy on the part of any particular campaign in messing with the Shadow app on Monday night. Mm-hmm. But I do think that when you want to know why was it that a company with relatively little experience in building digital election infrastructure was given such a critical contract, it makes sense when you think that, Tara McGowan's husband is a senior advisor to the Buttigieg campaign. And And also when you look at, you know, the kinds of relationships that other acronym officials have with either large tech companies or with the Democratic Party itself. For example, David Plouffe, who is a former Obama campaign manager, sits on Acronym's board. And this hasn't gotten discussed all that much, but Chris Cox, the former chief product officer of Facebook, announced that when he resigned from Facebook last year, that he was actually planning to get involved in Acronym as well, and that he had taken on an advisor role. Now, the extent to which these people are actually involved in the everyday operations, I don't know. And it's sort of beside the point that I'm making, which is that this network of relationships helps explain why the money flows to these people in the first place, independent of whether or not they're actually able to demonstrate that they can get results.
Yeah, it's like the situation where if you're a small business and you say, oh, I need an app for something, or I need someone to build a program, you say, oh, yeah, well, we'll use my uncle's kid. He knows how to build apps. It sounds like that, but obviously at a much larger scale, where it's not necessarily people who are qualified. It's just because, oh, well, they're part of our network of donors and the Democratic National Party infrastructure.
Right. And I believe that another thing within this acronym shadow kind of mess that's also worth looking at is the race to kind of introduce these new services and products without really any sort of serious vetting more broadly. There were a lot of concerns initially raised about Shadow in the week, in the run-up to Iowa, from a cybersecurity perspective and thinking about security vulnerability. But I think that some of the technical details that we've sort of been shown about how Shadow operated and how it was tested, really reveal that there's actually just an enormous amount of technical expertise that's missing from building these kinds of critical components, pieces of infrastructure for elections to be conducted. And that's not necessarily a new problem. We've had lots of issues, you know, hanging Chad ballots. I think lots of people remember also the horrors of Florida in 2000 and the recount. But I think that there's a kind of focus that needs to be shifted from these freakouts about cybersecurity and the Russians and hacking us to, I think, a more familiar and American problem of badly products being built badly because they were not paid for adequately.
Yeah,
it only cost $60,000, according to the filings, to develop this app, which, when you think about it, is kind of crazy, considering that's probably not even half the salary of a single digital engineer in, say, Silicon Valley.
Yeah, exactly. And even looking at some of the other projects that Acronym has launched, well, maybe not technically Acronym, but their subsidiaries, which largely are the same, one of them is called this Courier Newsroom type program, which is supposed to be a center-left type of newsroom that kind of takes the place of local news. And the idea is that Acronym, or whichever the subsidiary is that runs the Courier Newsroom, is that they're going to put out these Democratic-leaning stories on social media and get views and get impressions. But as it sounded like when you were talking with many employees, they were just churning out content and just saying, oh, well, look, we have X amount of views on this news article, when there's really not a whole lot of actual there. And that kind of goes to what you were talking about before, where it's more about actually having competent content that you're actually churning out rather than just actually churning out content for the sake of actually having content out there, if that kind of makes sense.
Yes, and I don't want to stress that Courier Newsroom is some sort of like nefarious kind
right.
of left-wing fake news mill, because I don't think that that's the case.
Yeah,
but I think
I agree. Mm-hmm.
What it speaks to is a kind of logic from particularly the consultancy kind of world, which is that, all right, we need to pump out lots of content that people will engage with and love. And there's a kind of cynical component to Courier Newsroom, which is that when it was initially launched, Tara McGowan, the head of Acronym, described it to Bloomberg as being something that would be like a replacement or something meant to fill the void of local news. And I don't think that Courier Newsroom is actually attempting to do that beyond just aesthetically representing itself as being like local news. And it reflects, I think, a kind of a real lack of kind of strategic imagination on the part of the people who run these kinds of companies, that those are the efforts that they're drawn to rather than, you know, necessarily funding actual journalism. I mean, for example, Think Progress, which had lots of journalistic credibility built up over more than a decade, was forced to shut down last year because the Center for American Progress didn't want to pay for it anymore. And I think that this kind of like that these sorts of projects housed within consultancies with no transparency and that are sort of architected around like kind of sneaky things like this local news business presentation, it doesn't strike me as a particularly productive path for billionaires. If billionaires' dollars are going to be spent on anything in Democratic politics, it doesn't strike me as a particularly productive use of them.
Yeah, it's all about actually making an efficient use of your dollars. And even as you spoke to a number of other people who are not affiliated with Acronym, but certainly are in that same sort of business, they also shared some concerns about that company, saying that they're just afraid that they're actually mimicking what Republicans do a lot by having these very kind of shadowy organizations with dark money, and they're afraid that, yeah, you can't actually just play the Republicans' game and try to win. Is that kind of what the feeling you were getting to when you talked to a number of other people?
Yeah, and I think that this is a sense that I also get less necessarily from speaking with people at Acronym, but from strategists, consultants,
right,
and other people in the Democratic world, which is that there's this kind of ambient concern about people wanting to beat Trump by emulating Trump because he's fighting a digital war and we're losing the digital war. And they use all of this very like macho gung-ho language about like winning the online war with, you know, we'll post better than them or something. And it's not necessarily a particularly effective way to think about it, but it does make for very good marketing when you're trying to solicit donors. I don't think that there's a lot of research that kind of indicates that the efficacy of this stuff is really there. And I would also further say that there is a real, real, real kind of problem, again, when it comes back to the lack of transparency around this stuff, that there's a whole, it's very difficult to sort of actually see, oh, this is the full range of things that they're doing, so we can actually say definitively whether or not it's effective or not, because this stuff, you know, it continues to operate a bit in the shadows. And part of that is just the nature of Facebook and what it doesn't show outside observers. And some of it is also just the nature of this kind of digital campaigning and the degree to which like Democrats and Democratic consultancies seem to be willing to, spend big on it, it's not heartening considering how much money they've seemed to have raised and given how many months are still left before November.
We've been speaking with Noah Coolwin. He is with The Outline, where you can find more information at theoutline.com. Noah, unfortunately, we are up against the clock, but a great conversation. And, definitely some good work you're doing over there, speaking with a number of sources that are uncovering kind of what's behind this Acronym group. So really appreciate your time today calling into the program, also on very short notice. Also happy about that, too, since I think I emailed you, 2 hours ago. So thanks again.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll take a break as you're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, and we'll wrap up the show with one more segment up next.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. I'm a better neighbor because my service has taught me how important it is to be a team player. My training helps me in my classes when I give attention to detail to the task at hand. My service also allows me to be there for my community in ways others can't. I help my hometown recover after nature strikes. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country and those I care about safe from threats. I also work with a network of professionals that help me succeed. Also, the Army National Guard's education benefits make getting a higher education a reality. Being an Army National Guard soldier makes living and serving in my community more rewarding every day. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Did you realize that Drink in the Style is available on iTunes, Google Play, and pretty much every other podcast platform out there? You can listen to past episodes of Drink in the Style, or maybe download our really cool martini glass graphic, or just listen to your favorite episode again and again. But if you do, I need to ask you for a quick favor. Hop online and give us a 5-star rating. It helps others find the show and also boosts my fragile ego. Drink in the Style. It's a great way to kill Sundays, or really, any time at all.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our new show airing on Saturdays from noon to one, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights to living and aging well. Each week, we provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and caregiver support to help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to one for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on your Wednesday afternoon. Yeah, great conversation with Noah over at The Outline, because he really does hit the nail on the head. It's not so much about, oh, well, this foreign country is trying to hack whatever electronic system we're using, whether that's the DNC server or, God forbid, actually our election machines. A lot of it actually just has to do with what he was talking about is a very typical American problem, which is actually having competent software. And that's exactly what we saw with this Iowa app, where we just were essentially having an app that was developed by a bunch of people who really didn't conduct any testing on this app. It was brought in through what it sounds like is a lot of cronyism, through people who were well connected with the Democratic establishment. And it's something that's not just exclusive to, as the point I was making, to big business. Oftentimes you see this in small businesses too, where, for instance, if I'm just launching a new small business and I need someone to build a website, I'm probably not going to put an ad out in the newspaper or online. I'm probably just going to go through my network of people and say, oh yeah, my brother's got a kid who knows how to build websites. Or, oh yeah, my former coworker has a friend who knows how to build websites. And I think that's actually what we saw happen in this situation, and it really blew up in their face. So, yeah, I just still find that funny, though, is that how this entire thing works, where you do have just these apps being developed by people who are clearly not qualified to do this, and I think that's the larger problem of what actually needs to be tackled. Let's go on to the phone lines and talk to Jennifer in Stillwater. Hi there, Jennifer. What's on your mind today?
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to announce that the 49ers won the Super Bowl, because at 0% of the game played, they gave a big victory speech. Hey, we don't need to any results. We won it.
I'll take it a step further, Jennifer. The 49ers were leading with about 10 minutes left in the third quarter, and that's what we're seeing now with the results being reported. I mean,
that's where I'm heading.
Is it likely that Buttigieg will hang on and win? Probably. I mean, Bernie would need quite a turn in the remaining 29%. Is it likely? No. But is it impossible? Also a no. So you're good.
And at 62% of the game played, the 49ers were still winning. And at 72, we're at 71% of results now, the 49ers were still winning.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they are deliberately cinching off which precincts they're releasing. And if you had done that, say, in Wisconsin, you just released Milwaukee County. Hey, Hillary won Wisconsin. But actually, it was the only county she won, okay? Or if you had done it in Minnesota, the counties that Hillary won, those precincts, then it would be, hey, Hillary won Minnesota. But then when you release the other precincts, so I think they're deliberately only releasing the precincts that Pete did well in.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Jennifer. I'd certainly have to do a little bit more research into that. Do appreciate the phone call, though, and encourage you to call on back to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Yeah, I'll have to do a little more research into whether they're actually doing that specifically on purpose. I'm not entirely sure. You had a thought on that, Eric?
I can't say it's on purpose, but I know that a lot of the precincts that are missing are in Polk County, which is where Des Moines is located, in one of Bernie's strongest places.
Mm-hmm. That's what I've always wondered, though, when it comes to primary voting, is that is it always urban areas that end up being the most liberal when it comes to primary voting? Obviously, in general elections, that's true, but something to look at in the future. So we'll have to see if that was actually being released for nefarious purposes. Again, not entirely sure on my part. Thanks for listening. We got Matt McNeil coming up next.